July 1968, the wreck of the Eleanor Doone. In the late 60s, a new pirate radio station launched from a ship off the west coast of Ireland. It was called Radio Eleanor. Broadcasting outside territorial waters, its stated aim was to bring new sounds to the musically deprived youth of the day and to challenge the conservative mentality that prevailed throughout the land. Buffalo Bill Cawley, being well-connected, succeeded in getting the band its first interview with Radio Eleanor's colourful disc jockey, Shaken Seamus Keogh. We were also slated to perform live on air, a prospect that had us bouncing from wall to wall all week. A good performance would win new fans and take the band to the next level. There was also the tantalising prospect of reaching my long-lost brother and sisters on air. For many is the young person who went to bed at night with a wireless radio under their covers. Radio Eleanor was anchored 12 miles off the Mayo coast and could only be reached by boat. A local fisherman met us at the pier in the town of Killala, and off we set in his battered old Curragh boat. It was a rocky ride on the wild Atlantic waves. The Dáil McCormack was quick to inform us of his terrible sense of foreboding about this whole affair. Now that the hour was finally at hand, Dixie Flynn and Desi were both bundles of nerves too. I was a very troubled man myself that evening, but for reasons far removed from the uneasy movements of the sea. I had dropped by Cawley's mansion earlier that morning to finalise plans for the on-air performance. Unfortunately, the only one home in that great big mansion of the West was the vivacious vixen Debbie, dressed as per usual in her summery swimsuit. The gods were certainly not sleeping on the job when they designed her. Only nature at its finest could mirror and reflect such immaculate beauty, if even at all. The golden hair, the big blue eyes, the bountiful breasts. Outside I could hear every bird in Connacht sing from the highest oak trees in unison, in harmony, in praise of the finest arse ever seen west of the broad River Shannon. Oh God, I beseeched, where was the man in the cowboy suit? Why, my favourite musician, she said, running her hand playfully down along my chest. Do come in. Whilst waiting for Cawley, she led me to the swimming pool out back. Against my better judgment, I followed like a submissive little boy, my clothes drenched in sweat and my heart thumping wildly like that of a hungry circus lion. In the shadow of the mossy green Galway hills, the beautiful pool glistened under the morning sun, and she stepped into the still waters and beckoned me to follow. Foolishly, I found myself wading in after her, and then I was her prey. She glided over, cornered me in those dangerous waters, and like a lizard wrapped herself tightly around me. My heart must have stopped from the shock before resuming again like an airplane engine. It was the first time I'd ever been kissed, not counting those two efforts in the fairy field, long ago. If she didn't stop, she'd smother me. And truth be told, I was happy to be smothered in the sinful way she coiled around me. All those years in the orphanage had isolated me from the world and the tangible pleasures that lurked outside. I wanted the moment to last forever. I kissed her deeply as her soft moans blended with all the singing birds of Connacht. I felt the eyes of all the mountain goats and sheep must have been on us, and it must have meant some feast for the eyes as she pulled me tighter and tighter and deeper into heaven. Or was this hell? But God forgive me, she was Cawley's girl. With a great shudder of guilt, I quickly came to my senses and freed myself from her serpent-like grasp. though it was hard to leave those longing eyes and those hungry kisses. I tumble out of the pool like a clumsy sod I was. With the blood returning to my feet, I shot out Callie's great big house like a cat with her tail on fire. I ran for miles and miles, and didn't stop until I'd reached the next village, where old women with black shawls draped around their withered heads looked at me askew, for I swear they knew in their hearts and in their souls that they had a sinner, a vile, rotten adulterer, in their midst. Whack me now on the head. Whack me with a stone and be done with it, I wanted to shout. Whack me now on the head with a great big stone. I saw her standing in the street above. In the distance, she appeared like a mad magpie before the full nun's regalia emerged into view.
You shot your true nature today, you filthy swine. Your poor mother will be turning in her grave at that class of carrion.
She turned to the old women in shawls.
Have you heard what he's done? Have you heard what this disgusting animal has done?
All the townspeople stopped in their tracks, turned an angry look in my direction, and hissed in disapproval at my behavior.
You dirty defiler!
Sister Philomena jeered.
You don't care about your family and friends. All you care about is the company of a harlot, a whore.
I wanted to run, but there was nowhere to go. All the townspeople were crowding in on top of me.
If you were as good at searching for your poor sisters as you were for desecrating another man's possessions, then you'd have found them long ago.
Rot in hell, an old woman clad in shawl cried. Yes, rot in hell, they all cried. Rot in hell, adulterer, rot in hell, rot in hell, rot in hell, hell, hell.
And now, as we rode on the choppy waters off the Mayo coast, I carried the weight of the world and bucket loads of shame on my shoulders. I had done something very bad, and all would not be right with the world again until something very bad happened to me. A great big battleship emerged from the ocean's fog. It was the Eleanor Dune.
Holy God! Said the Dal McCormick. She doesn't look very seaworthy, does she?
She survived two world wars, laughed the little old fisherman, looking at my battered old guitar almost disapprovingly. I think she'll survive you boys, too.
As the Eleanor Dune swayed to and fro on the wild Atlantic foam, a great big mast could be seen protruding towards the heavens, cutting through the fog, until it became invisible. Soon the mast would send signals throughout the land of a new and upcoming band called the Sodhoppers. I began to feel a little more at ease with that comforting thought. We climbed aboard the Eleanor Dune and might as well have arrived at a rural dance hall in the middle of nowhere. In days long gone by, in times of war, it may have thrived with soldiers and the big bands and pin-up girls who came to entertain them. But tonight, the old battle-weary ship was deserted. It would have appeared totally abandoned save for the distant sound of some old-time music that gently filled the air. We followed the music, a little unsteadily on our feet, for the sea was now growing rougher by the minute. The fisherman who'd shipped us here had disappeared into the fog on his way back home to Killala. McCormick, with a great deal of concern, yelled after him,
Mister, what about us?
But there was no answer.
There was no answer,
save for the squawks of a lone seagull stranded on the ship.
Brothers, I don't like the look of this place at all, said Dixie Flynn. Let's get this interview over fast.
belt out a few great songs, and then be out of here. We seem to walk for ages on the old battleship, and yet we're no nearer our destination. We still heard the old-time music, but the decibels never changed, neither growing stronger nor weaker. It seemed the song itself never changed. It became clear that the famous old disc jockey was probably the only one who lived on this ship, a one-man show. It would take some searching to find the location of himself and his turntables on this old giant of the high seas.
So that's where you are, a voice chirped from behind us. We've been looking for you boys.
The woman's voice startled us. We turned around to see a middle-aged woman, very pretty. I thought she spoke in a slight accent, but I couldn't quite fathom the country of origin, though it was certainly from the continent. Dixie Flynn nudged me, as if to say, "Not bad. Not bad at all, brother." But after my unholy dalliance that morning, I was giving all women a wide berth, lest I have all the men of Ireland on my tail. Her name was Elena, and while we struggled to stand straight on the rocky ship, she walked smartly ahead of us and led us to Sheik and Seamus Keogh's studio. "Brothers, she's the finest pair of legs that I have ever laid eyes on," said Dixie Flynn. "She must have been a dancer in her previous life, and I'll tell you, brothers, she's not past it yet. By God, she's not past it yet, brothers." Sheik and Seamus Keogh, with wild grey hair sticking out in every direction, had a little studio on the starboard side of the old warship. Old records were thrown all over the place, and it was his custom to dig from a heap, dust one off, and play a song from another age entirely. "Out here, no one can tell me what to do. I play what I damn well want. Elena, bring a pot of tea for these wretched boys." Dixie Flynn watched in awe as Elena, all very businesslike, marched out of the room. He shook his head in great admiration at those dancers' legs. And indeed, it appeared her skirt had grown shorter with every passing moment, revealing just how long and slender they really were. He was always the first to lecture us all on the guiles of the female folk. But it appeared on this occasion, in this strange location, he'd been completely bewitched himself. It was a helpless state to find oneself in, and one for which I had a great deal of sympathy and understanding, considering the day that was in it. "See this one here," said Sheik and Seamus Keogh, holding up a well-worn record. "I'm the only disc jockey in the world brave enough to play this one. You want to know why? You want to know why?" As he said those words, he peered at us all with his wild seafaring eyes, and then grinned, showing us all the full blast of his yellow, seafaring teeth. "Because it's a suicide song. That's why. I'm the only one with the guts to play a suicide song." He must have thought we were all a right group of stiffs, for we all stared at him blankly, none of us able to engage him in banter or have a quick one-liner at the ready. I thank God we weren't on air, for we were certainly nothing like the cool, quick-witted young bands often heard on nighttime radio. The uncomfortable situation was only allayed when Elena arrived with a tray of delightful cups of tea. "Well, that's the grandest cup of tea ever, pet," said Dixie Flynn, as he gave a great big sup and she smiled back at him in gratitude. "Many have killed themselves when I played that song. It's banned in every country in the world. Not so much the lyrics, but something in the tune that gets to them. Jump into rivers, jump in front of trains, you name it. There's no stopping him.
Well, glad I never heard it, or we wouldn't be here now.
Shaking Seamus Keogh broke into an unmerciful fit of laughter when the Dáil McCormack spoke those words. Spluttering, congested laughter that sent the contents of his chest and phlegm and spittle in every direction.
You're good! You're a good old boy!
Shaking Seamus Keogh then blew on the old 78 record, and as he did so, teacups could be heard clattering on saucers. A great look of concern descended on Elena's face. If she was worried, then I was worried too. What kind of dastardly place had the devil Callie sent us to at all? I'd heard of all classes of music. Music that sent you to sleep. Music that made you laugh. And music that made you weep. I'd also heard of a certain class that made you only long for death. And this sounded like the type of song that Keogh was about to spin. Was it the norm to bring young bands out here, play some suicidal music, elicit music prescribed in every nation on this planet, and then watch them jump overboard? No one would be any the wiser when their bodies were fish from the sea some days later. But Dixie had praised Elena's tea and admired her legs. Perhaps the feelings of admiration were mutual. I saw the way she smiled at him. He wasn't a bad-looking bastard when all was said and done. Surely she didn't wish this awful fate on the sodhoppers, and perhaps she'd ask Shake and Seamus to spare us. Even if my depraved soul deserved to be sent packing to the nether regions of hell. She didn't spare us. She waltzed out of the room, holding her head ever so proudly in the air, while Shake and Seamus lowered a needle into the record groove.
You're not going to play that. Jesus Christ, you're not going to play that.
The Dáil McCormack abruptly jumped to his feet as the record on the ancient old turntable started to spin. He grabbed Keogh's shoulder, screaming,
You can't play that. You'll kill us all.
As the worn old record crackled away, the suicide song started up. We recognized the air immediately. How much is that doggy in the window? Shaking Seamus Keogh split his sides and burst into a ferocious fit of laughter. It sent the contents of his lung flying in every direction again.
Fools of every time, listeners! Fools of every time!
The full horror of the night now dawned on each member of the sodhoppers. I looked at Desi, and the blood had drained from his face. Whatever chance the sodhoppers had of being the next hip thing went up in flames in that moment. Keogh had humiliated us. We'd have to bury our heads in shame. More is the pity the song couldn't make us die, for we all could have died a thousand deaths in that very moment. McCormack growled and clenched his fists in anger. Being the drummer, he was the fittest and the meanest of all. He was also the contrary one, the least likely to see the humor in things. He now adopted the pose of a street fighter and shaped up to draw a punch on the hoary old disc jockey. Dixie Flynn, seeing the fearful look on the big dark eyes of his beloved Elena, raised his hand and beseeched McCormack to keep his powder dry. McCormack reluctantly stepped away, muttering all kinds of profanities under his breath.
Can't believe you did that, said Desi. Can't believe that was live on air.
But everything is live on Radio Eleanor, laughed Shaking Seamus Keogh. We do everything in real time here.
Come on, lads, said Desi. Let's get our stuff and get off this dump of a ship. Desi had hardly uttered those words when an almighty blast was heard, A jolt that sent a stack of records flying and the rest of us sprawling helplessly to the floor. In the suddenness of the commotion, I looked up to see that Elena had fallen on top of me. Oh, Jesus, not again, I cried, as I pulled myself from the clutches of a seductive siren for the second time that day. The first blast was followed by another thunderbolt, a massive wave that seemed to split the Eleanor Dune in two. If we did not get off this boat, we'd perish here in the violent seas. In the background, a record continued to spin. Shake and Seamus Keogh never stopped laughing. The song remained the same, but it was a version I'd never heard before. We frantically lowered the lifeboat towards the roaring Atlantic Ocean as another giant wave pounded the Eleanor Dune. I have to go back and save her, brothers. No, Dixie, no. With Desi and McCormick waiting in the pitiful little vessel below, I dragged Flynn by the scruff of the neck, and we both plumped from the doomed ship. The lifeboat immediately tossed and tumbled on the vengeful seas, and the great big swells of water carried us towards certain destruction on the rocky Mayo coast. Behind us, the Eleanor Dune, the old battened hardened warship, made one last stand against its angry foe. Rattled and battered, the rusty old liner remained defiant to the end, but the ferocious ocean only roared back with thunderous intent. Great blasts of water surged into the night sky like an ancient monster from the deep, and then came pounding down with a terrifying force. The once queen of the seas took an almighty hammering. Soon, all that remained visible was the nose of the Eleanor Dune. Dixie Flynn held his head in his hands and cried. The ragged Mayo coast was just about visible under the howling moon. The sea continued to toy with us, tossing the lifeboat from wave to wave. We clung on for dear life, four wretched souls shivering and wet, as the angry Atlantic foams threatened to spew us all to the mercy of the rocks. The most malevolent wave of all then erupted from the bowels of the sea. The wee skitter of a lifeboat went belly up, upskittling the lot of us in the sea. It was cold, oh by God, the sea was cold. It seemed an awful way for a musician to end his days, drowned at sea and separated from his comrades, tumbling about like a lost boy in reckless, unforgiving waters. Last thing I heard was Kyo's voice, full of laughter. I'm the only one with the guts to play this song. Indeed, it was pure suicide to have gone out there in the first place. It was the kiss of life. She came to me. The angry waters with the disdain of a chief music critic that flung me about for hours. Were we that bad, I wonder? But she found me. Where? I was not sure. Was it some sexy sandy beach on some exotic island? For maybe I'd been washed ashore. She crawled astride me and lowered her lips to mine. She kissed me until the oxygen returned to my lungs. And once the life was back in me, kissed me profusely, sinfully and shamefully, with a little something that was just a little bit beyond love. Tebby, we can't do this, I said. We could do a lot more, the brazen hussy replied. She felt so soft and slippery and wet. If I had died there and then, at least I would have done so a happy man. I was found on Clue Bay, tangled in a great big heap of seaweed, making love to the slippery plants of the sea. McCormick had slapped me several times on the face before I came to my senses. My vision was blurred and my eyes were burning from the salt water. But I saw all three of them hovering over me, repeatedly calling my name. Are you okay, brother? Are you alive? I was alive. We were all alive. Call it the miracle of Clue Bay. Amongst the other flotsam and jetsam washed ashore as the morning broke was a green guitar. McCormick picked it up and strummed away. Jesus, it's still in tune, lads. Dixie Flynn stood on the shoreline, hands in pocket, looking out to sea. He fervently hoped something else would be washed ashore, but the lovely Elena would never be seen again. Come on, Dixie, we called. Let's go home, lad. He reluctantly bid the ocean goodbye, but not before picking up a poster that drifted slowly to the water's edge. He rolled open the soggy poster, and though the colour was well faded by now, we marvelled at the beautiful pin-up. She looked as radiant as ever. The skimpy clothes, the generous exposure of flesh, and those big dark eyes smiling straight at us. Brothers, did I not tell you she was a dancer? The tears flowed profusely from Dixie's eyes as he lowly spoke those words. He wasn't a man to fall easily, but when he did, he fell helplessly. There was something else on that poster, down at the bottom, and almost unreadable such was the battering the advertisement got at sea. Those were the words, performance, March 14th, 1943. Though I wanted to berate Cawley for the Eleanor Doone fiasco, I could barely look him in the eye. Such was the shame that burned upon my face. Got you boys another live interview. Mighty good one too. Ever heard of Radio Caroline? Another famous pirate radio station that broadcasts from a ship. Oh, well, at sea. Though his heart was in the right place. We told him we'd rather take our chances in the dance halls of rural Ireland. Someone was sure to notice us one fine day. Sometimes at night, while travelling the rural byways of my country, I'd always turn the dial on our makeshift radio in search of good music. Every now and again I'd happen upon Radio Caroline, and I'd shake my head in regret. Missed the boat there, was all I could think. One night another station came in through the static, barely audible, but the voice was unmistakable. Fools 'em every time, listeners. Fools 'em every time.